And that's kind of a good introduction to what Bill Watson is doing. Mark just told me. He is down in Nashville, Tennessee. It's about 90 miles south of Nashville. There is a museum there started by an amateur archaeologist whose name is Ron Wyatt. You probably never heard of Ronald Wyatt. You're going to see him on a videotape I have here because I want you to understand a little bit more about the Bible, and especially in chapters 6 through 9, Noah. Because this guy is probably the one who really did find Noah's Ark, photographed it, measured it, inspected it, and put a lot of instrumentation to test it, found things that you can't believe. And I'm going to cover that in my sermon today because, well, I've already covered a lot about Noah in the last two times I spoke here. This is the concluding sermon on this great prophet Noah. And you may have a few questions or ideas or things you want to talk with Bill about when he gets back. But at least you will get a little bit of an introduction into Ron Wyatt's museum that he's, I guess, where was he, when was he going to see it? Today or yesterday or?
Thursday.
Okay. So and then he probably went up to Nashville for the Sabbath. Okay. So I would love to go there. I would love, rather than go there, I like to go to Turkey and actually see it for myself. I am a little bit of a skeptic. I think you guys are wisely a little skeptical too. Meaning, you got to show me, you got to prove it. I'm not going to just accept your word for it. Well, that's the way I feel about several things in the Bible, including Noah's Ark. I've seen photographs of it. You're going to see a videotape. It's a little small, but I think you can hear the audio and then you can follow pretty well. And you're going to find out a little bit about Noah that perhaps you didn't really understand before. How can you learn anything about a guy who only has a couple of chapters in the whole Bible? Man, you can learn a lot from those couple of chapters. So I'm going to start out by putting my glasses on so I can see my notes. We want to read a little bit about this man and what he accomplished. In fact, you all can be very thankful to Noah, because I'm not sure if any of you would be here if it weren't for Noah. He and his sons built a boat. And it's not one of these boats like my wife's uncle built a sailboat in his basement, and he couldn't get it up out of the basement because it was too big. And I never did find out all about that, but it was kind of a joke among the people. Don't build something too big you can't get out of the basement. But he built a big boat. And this picture that you're going to see on this videotape will really illustrate that. It is a Ron Wyatt VHS tape. And that's the one that Mr. Watson went down this last Thursday to his museum. And by the way, he has passed away, and his wife is now running the operation there. But maybe he'll see some things that I'm going to go down there one of these days, too. Like I say, I like to go over to Ankara, Turkey, and go up to where the site is and actually see the thing myself. But you're going to see it on this videotape. So why don't you open your Bibles to Genesis 6, verse 6. We're starting with something that we've talked about it before as a reminder. Because some people think, well, God's a wonderful God, but God has no emotion. You know, where do you think you've gotten your emotions? Well, they just come with a body. You're right. Who put them there? God Almighty did. Genesis 6, verse 6 says this. It was a terrible world. Quote, and the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. He was so unhappy, he was grieved in his heart. Yeah, an emotion, all right, for all of us. And that shows you a little bit about God. He knows he invented all these things, and he put it in your body, but now he's given you something extra, a comforter called the Holy Spirit. So you can control those emotions. Sometimes I get carried away and I show a little emotion, maybe too much. I tried to get it in my voice, not in my tears or anything like that. Verse 22. Along came righteous Noah. And I think this is what God would like to see in all of us. Then Noah did according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. And he said to this, at that time he was 480 years old, I want you to build a boat. And you see the dimensions up there, verse 15. Length of the ark, 300 cubits. Breadth, 50 cubits. Height, 30 cubits. That's a big boat. That's bigger than a football field. So you got to understand, there was plenty of room for this boat, which didn't have to have an engine, by the way. They hadn't invented diesel yet. It had to float for a year, approximately, a little over a year. Land, and you will see all the things that Ron Wyatt and others have discovered. By the way, I'm not saying anything. In fact, I just heard from Margie something I wondered about, but I had never heard it. This man kept the Sabbath and the holy days. I didn't know that, but I think that's unusual. So why not reveal knowledge to somebody who understands the importance of it? Well, that's what they did. Genesis chapter 4. I'm going to turn back a little bit and read a verse here that's going to tie in to what I'm going to be talking about a little bit later. Genesis 4, verse 19. Now, of course, you know this is the line of Cain. Lamech, and that's down quite a few generations. But not to the time of Noah. Before Noah. Took to himself two wives. So here is really the first biblical example of a bigamist. He had two wives. One was Ada. Name of the other was Zillah. Ada gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. And his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who played the harp and the pipe. I'm not saying anything that music is necessarily wrong, necessarily bad, but sometimes it gets a little loud, a little carried away, but that's neither here nor there. Just to say, here are the people who invented this. Verse 22, as for Zillah, she also gave birth to Tubal-Cain. Took his great-great-great-grandfather's name, Cain, and added Tubal to it. Tubal-Cain. And it says, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron, the sister Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Nothing more is said about Naamah. You wonder, what in the world is that little verse doing in there? Tubal-Cain is very interesting. He actually was an instructor in how to work with metals. He understood how to mold things and melt things and combine metals, bronze, copper, iron. And you're going to see by the things in this videotape that a lot of things that no one knew, he learned from these people. He understood the importance of iron and its use in even building the ark. Now, you know, the first thing people say is, you mean they had iron in the ark? Yeah, folks, they even had titanium in the ark. Really? Well, you're going to read about it, you're going to see it, and it's really an established fact. Noah was no dummy. When you think about an ark that was, 515 feet long or something like that, how in the world is it held together? How? Oh, I know. The old Amish way. You use wooden pegs and hammers and you pound it together. No. He used rivets to hold it together. Steel or iron rivets. And you'll see that in the pictures a little bit later on. Genesis chapter 7, verse 4. Now, I want you to just remember that Noah now knew all about metallurgy and how to use metals. Because if anybody, how many of you folks here have ever been on a sailboat? Raise your hands. A few of you. Oh, okay, all right, some of you have. It has a very heavy lead ballast in the bottom, or, you know, a keel that really keeps the thing upright. You know, you wondered about it, haven't you? Wondered how in the world does Noah keep this boat upright? He used a lot of ballast of metal. And, of course, that's been found. But you have to understand that's all a part of making a boat. That had to live, oh, man, the tides that were pulled around that earth when there was nothing to stop the waters flowing back and forth, no mountains, it's all covered. It had to have a lot of strength. Now, you're going to see a little bit more about it. Chapter 7, verse 4. Let's turn ahead in the story. And after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. What is the significance of 40, that number 40? Does anybody know? Sure, you know. It's a trial or test. People had 40 days of fasting, trial or test. They are wandering in the wilderness 40 years, trial and test. Well, here it is, 40 days. Now, I don't know what would happen if Ohio had 40 days. I've seen some pretty bad rains just in the couple of months that I've lived here, and there's been some flooding out west even. Am I pointing right, Dave, when I say west? That's that. Which way is west? Which way is north? Up that way? I always get confused when I get up here. So I got to think. So north is this way? Okay. North, east, south, west. Now I got my bearings. Doesn't mean I'm going to point the right direction. But anyhow, you will understand what I'm talking about. 40 days and 40 nights is a lot of water. So the water was just pouring down. 40 days and 40 nights, it wasn't just the water from the heavens. It was all the artesian wells and the waters that just came up out of the ground. Covered the land. And you think, oh, well, it may be a swollen river or two. No, no. Everything was swollen. Every river overflowed its banks. Every mountain was covered. Wait a minute now. How in the world could Mount Everest ever be covered? Now, wait a minute. How do you know where there was a Mount Everest in the days of Noah? Chances are there weren't any real high mountains like we have today, which would make it easier because it describes how much water there was, and it doesn't talk about anything that high. So, it began to rain. Noah was 600 years old, and we covered that last time. When the floods came, that was in the year 1656. Anno Mundi, or after the creation. Verse 11 specifically states when it happened. The 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day all the fountains of the great deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were opened. Water on the ground coming out of the ground, water on the ground coming from heaven, and everybody fleeing for his life. Now, where do you suppose they fled? Well, I bet you there were hundreds of them were banging on the side of the ark. Because by this time now, God had told Noah, his wife, and his 3 sons and 3 daughter-in-laws, get in the ark, I'm going to seal it up. And he did. And then the boat just slowly floated off the land. As water got higher and higher and higher, the mountain peaks began to disappear. You know, the first time all the mountains were covered must have been a rather spectacular thing for Noah. Wow. It was all my friends, all the people. Nobody would listen. And people will say, well, why didn't Noah warn them? Folks, he was a preacher. He told them every Sabbath, you guys have got to repent because a flood is coming. He didn't hide it from anybody, but nobody believed him. He was a preacher of righteousness. So he did his job. And maybe in the world tomorrow when these people come back in the resurrection, they'll turn around and say, no, we're so sorry. We should have listened to you. But how many people died in that flood? A million? 10 million? I don't know. There were a lot of people in 1656 years. Remember how many children we've already talked about that Josephus said Adam and Eve had? How many boys and girls? 33 boys and 23 girls. And if that is a typical family, and these guys lived to, I think Adam lived to 930 years of age, and maybe Eve lived to 900 years, I don't know. And they had babies and babies and babies and babies. They just had a tremendous growth in the family of all around the world. It does talk a little bit about chapter 4 about the family of Cain. And some people have spent time studying that too, because we learn a little bit about the characteristics of some of the people. Verse 19, chapter 7. Waters prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heaven were covered. Some people claim that Noah's flood was merely a little local thing. It was just a little bit of overflow of some of the creeks. No, folks, it was a worldwide disastrous flood. It was so bad that God said, you know, I just can't do that ever again. And I'm going to tell the people of the earth, never again. Verse 22. All that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of life, died. Every living thing died from the land. Now, why doesn't it talk about the fish? You know, folks, I found a long time ago when I had my little, what do you call the aquarium thing there? Fish do real well in water. They don't have to have a lot of oxygen. They don't have to have a lot of food. I'm going to go in there and sprinkle a little food in there and get up there and they gobble it. And you do have, in an aquarium, you do have to have something that freshens the water. So that's why you see people put in little things that sends out a lot of bubbles. Well, they're aerating the water. So the fish can breathe. You take a fish out of water, boy, you've heard of the expression. He's out of water, or it's over his head, or whatnot. Fish can do real well. That's why God didn't tell you what happened to the fish. He just says all the mammals that breathe air, all the insects, all the birds, every critter that breathed air died. And some of us wonder, why in the world did he let one of those flies get in the ark? Well, I'm not going to answer that question because I don't have the answer. Maybe just to try us and test us. Who knows? Then go on to chapter 9 and begin to read verses 7 and 8. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Now this is one of the commands that Noah was given after all the earth was destroyed. He says, I want you to go out and I want you to repopulate the whole world. God spoke to Noah and his sons with him, saying, behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the field with you, all that come from the ark, even every beast on the earth. And I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the waters of the flood. Neither shall there ever be a flood to destroy the world or the earth. And then he gave that marvelous sign. And I think that you do have what up here in Ohio, too, by the way. It's not universal to Utah. It happens to be everywhere in the world, called a rainbow. And people think, wonder why that beautiful rainbow is for. It's to tell that there's never going to be a flood to destroy us again. Does that mean we don't have to have our water wings? Yeah, don't worry about them. It doesn't say anything about fire, by the way, because that's the way the earth is going to be destroyed the next time. Fire is going to destroy everything. Which would you rather have, flood of water or a flood of fire? Well, I don't want either. You won't have to worry about it if you're in the kingdom of God. So here's the command for God, and he gave them this great wonderful miracle, I guess you'd call it, the sign, rainbow. Then God said, all right, I want you to send a raven and a dove. Now, you've got to understand that a raven was sent out and a dove to test whether or not the water had receded from the earth. So Noah had a window up at the top that he opened it up. He put it, took out a little dove and raven, sent them out, says, go find some land. They didn't find anything. He came back. So he brought them back in. He waited. They were sent out again. And sure enough, this time, the dove came back with a fresh olive branch in its beak. And God knew then that things had really calmed down on the earth. And the eight people were able to finally leave the ark, begin to repopulate the earth. Maybe went a few miles away. They had all kinds of land, all kinds of room. They were on the mountainside, could see everything down. They walked down they went east a few miles and they had fertile valley. Actually, they went down into Iraq. And we hear about that all the time in the news. Well, that's where Abraham came from. That's where the saints began. This is where development of mankind really began, was in Egypt and in the area of the Euphrates and Tigris River, at those two valleys. Did I cover verses 18 to 23? Yeah, 18 to 23, chapter 9. Sons of Noah came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The order that they're in does not necessarily mean the order of their age. It just means that Shem was the favorite of the three. He's the more righteous of the three. Ham was the troublesome one. And you guys know who have multiple sons, that one has this characteristic, this nature. Another one may have a completely different nature. Ham had a kind of a bad nature in him. And we're going to read a little bit more about him. So these three were the sons of Noah, verse 19, and from these the whole earth was populated. How old was Noah, by the way, when the flood ended and he came back onto the land? Well, he was started, it was 600, it was 601 now. Flood took a little over a year. 601, he had three sons. Doesn't that seem strange to you that he lived for another 350 years? Never had any more children? You ever thought about that? Adam and Eve had 56 kids, and who knows how many the other people had. Noah had only three sons. What did he do? What did he mean he and Mrs. Noah do? She didn't do anything. She couldn't, because he couldn't. Why couldn't he? Well, let's read on. Verse 20. Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. How many people here like to raise grapes? I'm not talking about wine grapes, even just juice grapes. Do you understand a little bit about grapes? They're a strange plant. And it's a good analogy that Christ uses in the New Testament. I've got to prune the grapes. I've got to prune the branches. And I've got to cut off all the ones that don't produce anything and throw them in the fire. Because grapes are just one of those plants that can get real wild in a big hurry if you don't take good care of it, if you don't prune it. So now this doesn't say immediately. It just says that after the flood ended, Noah came out. He then planted a vineyard. And unfortunately, he drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. And this is one of those bad moments in Noah's life. He made a big mistake. And I don't know whether or not, maybe you'll be able to talk to him and ask him, but don't be embarrassed if he refuses to tell you. Because even the Bible doesn't say what happened to him. Ham, the father of Canaan. Now, why did it go back to Ham, one of the three sons, and talk about his kids, Canaan? Ham had four sons. Canaan was one of them. And we read in the Bible all about Canaan, the Canaanites, and how Israel had to defeat all of them. Many of them they just murdered, destroyed, burned up their cities, you name it. Let's just call a spade a spade. Exterminated them. Why were they so violent against the Canaanites? What did God have against them? Or let's expand it. The other three sons of Ham were also Mitzrayim, Cush, and Phut. They're all in Africa. And Africa today is the worst continent in the whole world. More sin and violence and trouble in that nation than anywhere else in the world. Why is that? Why is Ham so unlucky, you might say? Well, he's because he's so disobedient. He and his sons and grandsons just were so disobedient, they never accepted God's rule at all. In fact, they spent, like Cush, he was one of the pharaohs of Egypt, he destroyed a lot of Israelites, killed a lot of the boys so they couldn't even reproduce themselves. And well, that's another part of the story. I'm not going to get into that this time, but I will in the future. Verse 23, well, we mentioned that. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside, and Shem and Japheth, two other sons of Ham, of Noah, took a garment, laid it upon both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away so they did not see their father's nakedness. But Noah woke up from his drunk, the stupor, in verse 24, and what does it say he saw? He knew what his youngest son had done to him. It's talking about Canaan, who was actually his grandson through Ham. He knew what he had done to him. It doesn't say what he did, but cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. God enlarged Japheth, let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. So this guy, whatever he did, this probably a teenager or a 20-year-old or 30-year-old, just a young kid, whatever he did was cursed by God, by Noah, actually. It says in verses 20, 28, and 29, a little bit important bit of information, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. Had three boys. That's it. All the days of Noah were 950 years and he died. He produced three boys in the first 600 years and then nobody thereafter. Why in the world not? What did Canaan do to him? I don't know. The Bible doesn't even describe it. But he did something so terrible to Noah that Noah cursed him. He carried that curse and all his descendants forever. Many of them were destroyed when Joshua came into the promised land. And I'm not going to even speculate exactly what may have happened. Maybe I'll ask Noah someday. But I don't know. Maybe it's too private to even know. That's another very important point. In this verse. Now, how old was Noah when the flood of waters came? 600, right? He lived 350 years after the flood for a grand total of 950 years. So you learn something from that that some of the experts really completely ignore. After the flood means what? When do you start measuring after the flood? And the answer is the way Noah did. He lived 350 years after the flood began, not after it ended. It's very important to understand that because in chapter 10, it talks a little bit about the descendants. If we have enough time, we'll go through that. Let's read over here. Let's skip over to chapter 11 and verse 10. These are the records of the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old, became the father of Arphaxad, 2 years after the flood. After the flood began, folks, not after it ended, after it began. That gives you an idea of where you can really get fouled up in chronology if you're not careful. Chapter 10, verses 6 to 9, I want to read that. Sons of Ham were Cush, Mitzrim, Put, and Canaan. Or Put and Canaan. Depends on what kind of translation you have there. The sons of Cush were Sheba, Havilah, Sapta, Rama, and Sapteka, I think that's pronounced, and the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. Cush became the father of Nimrod. Nimrod was Noah's grandson, folks. A lot of people don't understand. Wait a minute, he was the son of Cush, who was the son of Ham, who was the son of Noah. So that makes him directly descended back to Noah. What's it say about this man, Nimrod? He became a mighty one on the earth. You know, that's a subject of the next sermon I'm going to try to bring you, is you got to know a little bit about this guy called Nimrod. You've already learned a lot about Noah. Now I'm going to teach you about the other, I call them the two ends in the book, in the Genesis. Noah, Nimrod. And he started the world's great religion. You know, he was smart enough to realize people love to worship something. They like to pay obedience and obeyance to somebody or something. They like to worship something. Some of the descendants of Ham like to worship rocks and trees and critters. They didn't like to worship God, anything but God. Well, that's even true today. Let's read verse 25, chapter 10. Sons were born to Eber. The name of one was Peleg. For in his days the earth was divided. His brother's name was Joktan. What does it mean, the earth was divided? Oh, well, that's when the land masses formed. Is that what you mean? And South America or Africa slid away from South America? No, that's not what it means. It's talking about the yearly division that occurred in the whole world in chapter 11. It talks about language division. It was divided up among people who spoke normally whatever it was when they first started out, and all of a sudden everybody's language was confounded, confused. And they couldn't do anything more. And they were in the very active process right then of building this beautiful city and huge tower, reached all the way up in the heavens, called Babel. But we're going to get to that later. And I'm going to take time to talk about chapter 11. That's the Tower of Babel chapter. But it is a very important time because this is where Nimrod really came into his own, and his, I call it, mother slash wife. What do you mean by that? I mean, she was his mother, but she was also his wife. What? That sure sounds weird. Yeah, he was weird. Semiramis was her name. She was, at one point, she was Cush's wife. Later on, she married Nimrod. That may have been after Cush died, but that's okay. We'll get to that later on. Shem was a good son. His line is described, chapter 11, verses 10 on, all the way down to Abraham. Ah, I knew about Abraham. There's the father of the faithful. He was a good guy. And he had a good son, Isaac, and his son, well, he had one good son, Jacob. I don't say that much good about Esau, but at least Jacob was a good son. And he had good sons, too, part of the Israelites. We're going to learn more about this guy, Shem, because he really did play an important part in the life of Nimrod, even. Actually, he played a good, important part in the death of Nimrod. In fact, he was the one who assassinated him. Shem, he assassinated Nimrod, tracked him down, and where do you suppose he found him when he tracked him down? Tradition says found him in Italy, what's commonly called today Italy, killed him, and then did to him kind of an unnatural thing, but necessarily was what he had to do. He cut him up. He cut him up, and he spread his body around the world, pieces of his body here and there, to warn people, this is what's going to happen to you if you are disobedient to God. Of course, Nimrod was very disobedient to God, so he was really put to the end of his misery, and his body was chopped up, sent around. And they, later on, they began to gather all the parts of his body, and they then claimed, oh, wow, Nimrod is reborn. He's come up out of the grave. And that's all a part of this mystery religious system that we're going to learn about next time I talk. Because we got to know a little bit about why this world is so deceived, so mixed up. And that's all really covered in the story of Nimrod. God is trying to reestablish his government on the earth. And he's giving you just the highlights of things in the book of Genesis. And you're going to find there's a number of very surprising facts about Nimrod and Semiramis. And she was quite a lady. A lady is really a polite way of talking about Semiramis. She was a broad. And now maybe that's the best way to describe her. She wasn't really a wonderful woman. Oh, she may have been a really beautiful looker. But she and her son, her wife, Semiramis, started this great religious system that has deceived this whole world. We'll get to that later on. Nimrod was one of the guys who went from good to bad. And the whole nation, continent of Africa, has gone from good to bad. And they have war all the time down there, in places you never would expect it. For a while they had trouble in South Africa, and they have trouble in Kenya. They have trouble in this nation or that nation. And they have all this violence everywhere. And I don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's whoever makes in the kingdom of God and draws that short straw, that's what I call it, and is told by God, I want you to go down there to Kenya and clean it up. Teach those people how to live the right kind of life. It's going to be a tough job. Somebody's got to do it, though. You're going to have a lot of power from God to do it because those people are so stubborn. They're so rebellious. They're so pagan that they have never really wanted to obey God. All right, so that should give you a little bit of an idea of where we've been and Noah and what he's done. And you're going to see in this VHS tape, you're going to find that Noah had the smarts to build a big boat, but he knew how to build it so it could stand the great tides and the flood waters and live on water for a year. And you're going to find that they use some of the most fantastic things. And I know you probably have heard about some of these things. You know, where did plywood come from, for instance? You know that was used on Noah's Ark? Plywood? Yep. Because they had decks on Noah's Ark. And they had all kinds of space for all the animals. And you're going to see some of the pictures describing in this VHS. And I have another VHS I'm not going to show this time, but it's called Surprising Discoveries, and it's by Jonathan Gray. And it shows a picture of what he thinks Noah's Ark looked like. Has it been found? So he goes in there. He adds a lot of verbal things to what Ron Wyatt already found. And he wants to make his buck by selling VHS tapes. Well, I gather things like that. And I like to find out more about Noah's Ark because it's all in the Bible and I want to know more about the Bible. And that's something that should motivate all you to find out is more about the Bible. And that's the whole purpose of this. So I would like somebody to come up here and start this thing because I do not know how. Oh, good, thank you. And let you relax and watch Ron Wyatt in action.
At a time when many on this planet are in despair, and governments look for solutions to the great problems of mankind, a series of discoveries have been brought forward to encourage us that there is still hope for our world, that God has indeed interceded in human history in the past, and that at the proper time, He will do so again. Editor of National Geographic magazine once stated, "If the Ark of Noah is ever discovered, it will be the greatest archaeological find in human history." On June 20, 1987, the Turkish government announced to the world the discovery of the remains of Noah's Ark based on 10 years of intensive research by Ron Wyatt of Nashville, Tennessee. They commissioned the building of a visitor center overlooking the remains and set the immediate area aside as a national park. Ron was invited as the guest of honor at the dedication ceremony, which was attended by numerous Turkish government and military dignitaries. In 1959, during a NATO aerial photographic mission, a Turkish army captain photographed an unusual boat-shaped object located 12 miles south of Mount Ararat. It appeared to be the approximate size of the biblical ark. These pictures, along with an article on the subject, were published in the September 1960 issue of Life magazine. After studying these photos, photogrammetry expert Dr. Arthur Brandenberger stated, "I have no doubt at all that this object is a ship. In my entire career, I have never seen an object like this on a stereo photo." 17 years later, in 1977, Ron Wyatt made his first trip to this area to specifically look for this formation. During that trip, he and his two sons not only found the boat-shaped formation, but also several huge drogue-style anchor stones that they believed were associated with the Ark. These stones appeared to be aligned along the path the Ark might have taken as it came to rest in this part of eastern Turkey. On these stones, he found several iconographic inscriptions which he believed represent the 8 survivors of the flood. Bill points these out.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
this region caused the earth to drop away from the formation, exposing rib timbers and deck support timbers along the sides. Ron was able to take samples of the petrified wood and the soil around them. On analysis, the samples were found to contain a higher than normal level of organic carbon, indicating that this was indeed once a wooden object. In the 1980s, with the cooperation of the Turkish government, Ron and his team were able to do several metal detection surveys, which revealed that the timbers were held together with metal rivets and plates.
Our last trip out there this past June, we found this very impressive rivet. And if you'll notice here, the plate itself is just a little more than a quarter of an inch in thickness. It's approximately 3.5 inches in diameter, the plate itself, and then the shaft of the rivet is roughly 1 to 1.25 inches in diameter. And if you'll notice here, it was struck while it was hot and flared out the end of the shaft so that it would not slide back through the hole in this washer. And this shows that their abilities to use metal was quite advanced, quite sophisticated. And folks, there are thousands of these rivets on this boat. In fact, at every joint where the wooden structures are held together, they're held together by large metal plates, which are predominantly iron, and then these rivets.
Ground-penetrating radar scans of the formation revealed a huge man-made structure beneath the surface of the formation, which included keels, decks, bulkheads, and all the other parts of an ancient boat. It was during one of these scans that Ron located just below the surface what ended up to be a large piece of a petrified deck timber. On examination, it was seen that it was laminated. That is, it was made up of 3 separate layers of wood, as you can see in this view.
Do you believe Noah's Ark actually existed? Could the legend that sounds like a fairy tale really become proven fact? Well, the search has been going on since biblical times. And in a moment, you're going to meet some people who are positive they have found the Ark. Now, we know such claims have been made before. But a few months ago, these people came to 2020 with some new and intriguing scientific findings. We followed them to the mountains of eastern Turkey. And what you'll see is a bizarre adventure with a host of unlikely characters. Tom Gerald's story takes many twists and turns.
That's the seductive beauty that brings them here, snow-capped Mount Ararat. The explorers looked for the Ark there since that's the highest point around here. And as the floodwaters receded, presumably that's where it would have landed. But the Bible describes the mountains of Ararat, mountains, plural. Is it possible that the Ark came to rest on one of the smaller sister mountains to Ararat?
The boat-shaped site was first found and photographed by a Turkish army captain back in 1959. It was quickly explored and dismissed as a freak of nature. But Wyatt, an amateur archaeologist, rekindled interest in it a few years ago. He brought in Dave Fassel, a marine salvage expert, to assess it. The Doomsday Mountain team brought in some high technology to explore the oldest legend of man. They began scanning their site with a molecular frequency generator. It's a device used by surgeons to pinpoint cancer tumors, and it's been used by Fassel to locate underwater treasure. This time, the molecular frequency generator began to pick up a unique pattern of iron lines beneath the earth.
Okay, bring that one up.
They began placing ribbons along those lines. The finished shape, outlined by the ribbons, was that of a huge ship, the approximate length and width of Noah's Ark, as described in the Bible. The fascinating field of ribbons soon attracted higher academic interest.
That looks like iron. Okay.
Dr. John Baumgartner, a physicist with Los Alamos Laboratories, sent samples back to the lab for analysis and confirmed that the metal they were tracing with the ribbons was indeed iron. With the width and the length known, the only remaining question was depth. By locating the depth of the hull, they could determine if the boat-shaped object had the cargo capacity described in the biblical Ark. To resolve this final issue, Wyatt and Fassel brought geologist Tom Finner to Turkey with his company's heavy-duty subsurface radar equipment. Gear like this located the black box cockpit recorder on the floor of the frozen Potomac River after the Air Florida crash.
Suppose this rock were 1 foot or 2 feet underground. Would it give you a reading as to where that was? Could you locate it?
Yes, we could.
Is it possible that there will be a moment at which you'll say, this is a man-made object?
The symmetry of the feature suggests it's about I hope to prove that the underground structure is, in fact, that of a boat.
It was here, several miles short of the boat-shaped site, that a waiting game began for Finner and the others. The party needed a final go-ahead from the Turkish government to complete their probe of Doomsday Mountain.
Anyway, we're going to hang in like smell on a skunk till nothing left. Get this done.
Hang in like the smell on a skunk. The Turkish government stopped the exploration. What now?
Since we were there, Barbara, things have cooled down, and they've sent their own team of scientists in to take a look at this site. It's a very fascinating location.
In August 1985, he receives the necessary permits and clearance to perform the radar examinations. At long last, they perform the scan, and the results are stunning. Before their very eyes, the machine tells the story of what lies beneath the surface of the object. There are massive keelsons, deck timbers, open chambers, gunnels, and other various configurations which Ron and other specialists believe identifies the object as the remains of an ancient man-made ship.
Indeed, there is something beneath that rock besides rock. A radar device developed by Geophysical Survey Systems in Hudson was used on the mountain. The device called SIR is used by energy exploration companies to analyze what's below the Earth's surface. According to SIR, something man-made is under Mount Arredog.
This data does not represent natural geology. It's a man-made structure. These reflections are occurring very periodic, too periodic to be random natural type interfaces.
Since Ron's initial work, a number of other artifacts have been found by himself and various others who have worked at the site. As to the anchor stones, 13 in total have been found. Each is approximately the same size, although some of them have been broken over the years. Each has the very distinctive rope hole at the top. Most have crosses carved on them, although two of the stones have been found with no inscriptions whatsoever. Numerous pieces of petrified wood have been found in and around the site, such as these samples. In 1998, while surveying the site with other scientists, Dr. William Shea of the Biblical Research Institute found a pottery shard about 10 meters from the western side of the formation. On one side is painted the picture of a man releasing two birds. On the other side is etched a picture of a man with a hammer in his hand driving a spike or nail. The man is wearing some type of a headdress. Across the front of the headdress, the name Noah is written in proto-Sinaitic text. This is the first piece of hard evidence that directly ties any ark site to the biblical character Noah.
What we actually have found is physical evidence that this is a boat. Whether or not it's Noah's Ark is up to the people that review the material. That's up to them to decide on that. My personal feeling is that it is Noah's Ark.
Since Ron's death in August 1999, several of his associates have continued his work. In February 2000, the political situation in eastern Turkey improved dramatically. Since that time, it has been possible to work in relative safety in the area. A number of other objects and inscriptions have been recently found that are believed to be associated with the Ark. These are currently being analyzed.
All right, do you have any questions? It's very interesting, isn't it? Would God, by any chance,
make this available to the populace in general as one final witness that the Bible is true and Noah's flood really did occur? I can't answer that. I would love to go over there and see it. I would love to display what I can find. I hope that Mr. Watson, when he gets home, has seen some of the artifacts from Juan Wyatt's museum and maybe can tell a little about what he has seen.